This is the Skirted Roundtable. I'm Linda Merrill from Surroundings.
And this is Megan Arquette from Beach Bungalow 8.
And this is Joni Webb with Cota, Texas.
And this week on the Skirted Roundtable, we are welcoming noted California antiquarian Lee Stanton to the table. And so, Lee, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. I was looking forward to this.
Oh, yes, yeah, so are we. We, as we do with everybody, we want to hear about your background, how you developed an interest in antiques, and your expertise. So tell us all about yourself.
Okay, well, first of all, I grew up with antiques. My mother would take me antique shopping probably from the age of 6 years old. So I acquired a taste from an early age. My father had passed away, and I spent a lot of time with my grandfather as well, who was a woodworker and a restorer. And that gave me, and I spent a lot of time with him in his workshop and developing an understanding of woods and finishes and so on and so forth. So between my appreciation for antiques at such an early age and the knowledge of being around woods with my grandfather, it seemed like a natural. However, once I went to school at USC, and when I graduated, I started a publication and was in the publishing business for 10 years. And after the publication grew to a certain level, it just the sort of creative side of it went away. And I found myself involved in the politics of running a large business, dealing with employees and, having to perform sales and sales reports and all that type of thing. And I really sort of got discouraged because I lost the creative aspects of the publishing business. And so I had the opportunity to sell the business and get into the antique business when a noted antiquarian, Gep Durenberger, decided to retire. He approached me, and he knew my knowledge of antiques and my appreciation, and I worked with him on several different committees, and he said he would like me to take over his business, and it happened to come at the right time, and here I am today.
I didn't realize that you basically bought his business, Gep's business?
Yeah, I purchased Gep Durenberger's business in San Juan Capistrano 20 years ago, and was there for 10 years before I opened my shop in Los Angeles. And I mean, prior to opening the showroom in Los Angeles, I had a large clientele from Los Angeles and around the country. We would bring in containers. This was back, in the days when the economy was really great. And we would bring in containers of antiques, and people would just be waiting outside for us to open that container door. And they would just fight over pieces. I had a lady open an armoire door on another lady's head, and they were she ended up with a black eye, and that type of things happen. And one day I had a container that came in, and I'd say 80% of the container went back to London, which is where the container came from. A dealer had come in from London and purchased about 80% of the container and took it all back to London.
Oh,
and
wow.
I think the people that made the most money on that were the shippers,
right?
on that container. But no, the designers would come down and they would use me as a resource. And so it was just a natural progression for me to move up to Los Angeles. And it was a great opportunity for me to expand my, my product line and to have a more eclectic look, which is what I really appreciate. And there's a lot of creativity in Los Angeles, a lot of talent, and I'm very honored to be a part of the Los Angeles Design Quarter, because these were all people that I admired so much when I was down in San Juan Capistrano, and I would come up to Los Angeles, and a lot of those colleagues are fellow members of the Los Angeles Design Quarter.
But and you do some design, right? You will occasionally take a client.
Yeah, I'll occasionally take a client on, and but primarily I do it to stay in tune with the textiles that are out there, the latest products. The majority of my business is to the trade. We're not limited to the trade, but the majority of my business is to the design trade. And I really, don't feel that I want to aggressively pursue interior design because I feel it's a conflict with the designers that support me. But I do it mainly to stay up on top of all the things that are out there in the design business. It forces me to go out and look at things outside the antique world, look at the textiles, look at, you know, some of the latest products out there that are, you know, in other industries besides the antique business.
Do you primarily deal with English antiques?
I would say probably about 50% of my inventory is English, probably 20% of it is Italian, and the remaining 30% is either French or Belgium.
Do you have a preference, like a favorite or whatever just strikes your fancy?
I think all of them have their qualities to them. You know, I think the English ingenuity and some of the clean lines of English antiques are really great. However, you know, the artistry in an Italian piece is incredible as well. And of course, the Belgians are so great with their sense of style and putting a little twist on everything. And it's been historically that way. I mean, not just in the last, I mean, everyone hears about the Belgian market right now, and everyone's, you know, it's the quite the hype. But, you know, the Belgians have always had a great sort of, they've always stayed ahead of the design curve, even historically, because they always sort of, you know, competed with the French. And so it, you know, it's forced them to stay on top of things. And the design industry in Belgium and the things that are coming out of Belgium are great, both currently as well as historically.
Well, they had such a strong appreciation for craftsmen. With all the guilds, I think it was one of the strongest in Europe, wasn't it? Sort of the epicenter.
Right, yeah, definitely.
For a long time.
And art as well. You know, the Belgian, great art.
Could I ask you the publication name that got you started?
I wanted to
know
that.
I'm just curious.
It was called Senior Highlights. And okay. The reason I laugh is because it was a publication for senior citizens, and everyone sort of...
Was it like Highlights magazines for seniors?
Yeah, it was like a Highlights magazine for seniors, and it had nothing to do with the design business, but...
Okay.
Did you have a Find the Hidden Picture page?
No,
you mentioned the creativity of it several times, so...
I mean, that was what was nice about it, is that a lot of people, a lot of the publications out there, a lot of the marketing materials for seniors, you know, they're people don't respect them as somebody that appreciates good design. And that was one of the things that it was actually a project in college that I was dealing with the aging market and studying the aging market. And I realized that there was no great looking publication that treated seniors with respect and with dignity and a sense of style. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to create. And I was able to make it successful and see the success of it. But, you know, like I said, it just got to the point where, you know, I was dealing with status reports and everything got so technical that I lost that sort of involvement in the creativity end of it. And the antique business, like I said, it started out, I thought, when I sold the publication, I had the financial means to buy a nice collection of antiques and to buy the business from Mr. Durenberger. And I thought, I'm just going to, you know, sort of go over to England and France and Belgium and Italy and have these nice little excursions and buy some antiques and have a shop that's sort of open part-time and just kind of enjoy semi-retirement. But, you know, shortly afterwards, I realized that, you know, I have a business aspect to my personality, I guess, and
you can't do it halfway.
It gradually turned into a business and a full-time business, and you know, where I'm importing antiques for 4 to 6 times a year. And
do you still go to Europe yourself?
Oh yes, okay. I select all the merchandise myself. And I think that is probably what people appreciate the most when they come into my shop, is that you know, everything has a very hand selected feeling to it. You know, it doesn't, you don't, I think the most successful antique shops out there are people that love antiques. And so they have an appreciation for it. And they're not selling antiques like it's a commodity. I think you can very quickly run into an antique shop that somebody is just buying antiques in order to sell them and not appreciate them. And I think that is one of the formulas for my success in at Lee Stanton.
And do you, you've mentioned that you also sell to the public. Do you have people who come into your shop who you sort of guide through maybe buying their first antiques, or does someone really need to substantial budget to be able to come in to your shop and actually purchase?
I think that I try to have something for everyone as far as price points. I love to help people start collections, and I think a lot of that is, you know, understanding their taste and what turns them on, and then just going from there and making sure, you know, the main thing that I can do is steer them in the right direction as far as a collection that, you know, could eventually, that you can start off at an entry level, and then as you evolve, you know, buy more serious antiques. However, having said that, I think many of the antiques that I sell are to non-collectors, mainly because they like the look, and they're buying the antique for the look rather than as a collection.
I was just going to say, I see that you're on your website, your showroom just looks gorgeous with the wood floor, that you have a lot of painted pieces. Are you invested heavily in that kind of look now?
I have a nice collection of painted pieces. I like to be very careful with painted pieces because, unfortunately, painted pieces are the easiest pieces to replicate today. And it's the easiest thing to make a mistake on. And so rather than to have pieces that my clients will be disappointed in, I'd rather buy a limited amount of painted furniture that I feel 100% comfortable in selling that is authentic and real, rather than something. I mean, it's easy to take some, you know, a half broken down piece and add to it and build it, rebuild it, and so on and so forth, where only 50% of the piece is real, and you know, throw some paint on and scratch it off and make it look pretty authentic, where you can't do that with a nice, you know, wood piece with a wood finish versus painted pieces. So as far as I feel, I have a responsibility when I'm selling pieces to sell authentic pieces. And so keeping that in mind, I'm careful with the painted pieces that I buy and that I sell, because I only want to sell pieces that are real.
What would you recommend if someone, particularly someone who's, you know, unschooled, what would people want to look at? So if they're looking at a painted piece that they love and it's being told to them, this is a true antique, a couple of things that they should really look for that might be a tip off that it's not.
Right. Well, number one, to buy some from somebody that you feel
reputable.
Comfortable, that is
yeah.
a reputable dealer. I think that's the most important thing. Secondly, to look on the inside of the piece. On the outside, everything can look really nice, but you can usually tell on the inside of the piece if the piece is painted on the inside, then that's a pretty dead giveaway that something
is fake. Yeah,
that they're hiding it, because the antique pieces, generally speaking, they didn't paint the insides of. And so when you look at the inside, you want to look at the type of wood that is on the carcass of the piece, or the outside of the piece, versus the shelves and so on and so forth, and the back, and see if it looks like it has the same patina. You know, bother to look at the piece upside down. Ask the dealer to turn the piece upside down. Look at it from upside down, from underneath. And I look at further things like construction, but which we could get it technical into the type of construction and how things are. You know, you want to look for circular saw marks versus hand-hewn marks. You look at the types of nails that were used or the dovetailing that was done. But all that, you know, we, you know, if we had a couple hours, I could go into it in a lot more detail. But,
you know, I don't know. I always feel like, I mean, I have no formal training at all, but I always feel like I can just look at something and you can kind of like tell automatically if it's a, you know, if it's like a reproduction or a fake or whatever. But do you have a story about ever getting fooled badly?
No. I'm trying to think, you know.
That's an interesting question.
It happened, you know. I mean, I know it just happened at Round Top. The girl that owns the Paris website, the antiques, and she bought something, and you know, she can spot a fake. I mean, and it was a mirror, and it accidentally broke or something, and it came off, and she saw the back of it that had been hidden in the encasement, and you know, it was a fake, and she was shocked.
I've been fortunate that, you know, like I said, maybe this has to do with my background and all the way back to the age of, you know, 6 or 8 years old dealing with this. I've been very fortunate. What I have made a mistake on is there are probably two mistakes that I, you know, still have to train myself to avoid. And that is usually when I'm on a buying trip, I start out at, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning. I've arrived at midnight the night before. I'm out at flea markets, I'm at antique shops, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'm working until 8 o'clock at night. So, you know, after about 3 days of that, I'll go into an antique shop or at an antique show and sit in a piece of on a chair or a sofa, and I'll think, wow, this is really comfortable at that stage. Anything. And so I get it back to my showroom and put the chair or the sofa or whatever the piece happens to be in my showroom, and people, oh, this is really a good looking chair, and they sit in it, and all of a sudden they get this look like, oh, this is the most uncomfortable chair. It was comfortable when I bought it.
No, that's funny. Well, I noticed on your website you talk about the importance of function and comfort. So do you generally try to stick with, you know, we've all seen antiques that's like, well, that's really pretty, but you'd never sit on it.
You know, my showroom, I don't really have what you would call precious items that always have to be behind glass doors. You know, like you mentioned, I like pieces with function. I want a piece that people can actually use and enjoy, and every time they walk through their house, they can feel good that they purchased it and not feel that they have to treat it with a white glove. You know, my feeling is that antiques were made to live with. People set drinks on them. They you know, put their feet up on them, you know, whatever. They used the pieces. And if the pieces could withstand 100 or 200 years, they can certainly withstand, you know, what we put them through today.
Lee, can you talk to us a little bit about the Legends of La Cienega that you're involved with?
Okay. Well, Legends of La Cienega was started last year out of an organization that I helped to organize called the La Cienega Design Quarter. And it is made up of almost 50, I think we're up to 50 members. And all my colleagues on the boulevard and up and down Melrose Place and Melrose Avenue, we decided to put on this event last year, and it was called Legends of La Cienega, and we did a tribute to past designers, noted designers such as Billy Haynes and Billy Baldwin, and several different designers, about 20 different designers. And this year, we decided to do a tribute to film, and it is called Legends of La Cienega Celebrate Hollywood, and it's a tribute to design and film and television. This year it's really exciting because in addition to the 20 interior designers that are presenting vignettes in all of our windows up and down the boulevard and up and down Melrose Boulevard as well, we have set decorators that are participating. And the interior designers are doing vintage, for the most part, vintage films. and television shows. And the set decorators are doing current works for the most part. And so they are doing shows like Mad Men, Entourage, Glee. We have a new movie that's coming out that's apparently an incredible film that was a remake of a French film called Dinner for Schmucks. And that film is going to be released in May, just at the same time as Legends of La Cienega. So anyway, this legend started basically as vignettes in our windows. And the idea was to take items from other showrooms and mix it up and have a sort of a sense of community. So for instance, something, a designer that decorates my window may use something from Ralph's Antiques or from Therion or from Salon and in my window and vice versa. And the idea was to sort of cross-pollinate the boulevard and create additional exposure for everyone. And
who was in yours last year?
Last year, Waldo Fernandez did my window, and he did Billy Haynes. And this year, I have Jane Hallworth is doing my windows, and she is doing, I have two windows, and one of them is the movie The Birds, and the other one is Clockwork Orange.
Oh,
so, and the films are going, and that's kind of the fun thing about this, is that there's going to be something for everyone. Everything from Clockwork Orange to Out of Africa to Fountainhead. We have Cleopatra, the movie Cleopatra. We even have Rami and Michelle's High School Reunion. You know, we have a lot of different films, and it's really going to be great. And then, in addition to the vignettes, we have a whole lineup of talks, and there's 14 keynote presentations with panels, and then in addition to the keynotes,
and those are all open to the public, right?
Everything is open to the public, yes.
Uh-huh.
With the exception of a few of the cocktail parties,
right?
And every, you know, this event is sponsored by El Decor. And they've given us a lot of support in helping us produce this event. And we were able to get a great lineup of speakers. I mean, there's, you know, we have great topics, everything from Hollywood glamour to vintage lineage to we even have a sort of a blogging topic called Design Diaries, how the blogosphere is reshaping the design world. And so
who's giving that talk?
On that panel, it's Joy Cho from Joy, Janet Hall from Remodelista, Gregory Han from Apartment Therapy, and Cassandra Laval from Coco and Kelly.
Wow.
I know. So, I'm really excited that you all are sort of branching outside of the really interior design-centric bloggers, because all of those... Joy actually does a lot of graphic design, doesn't she?
Yes.
On hers?
Well, it sort of shows, yeah. It sort of fits in with the whole cross-pollination.
Yeah, it does,
nice.
Exactly.
It's kinda neat.
And I thought that's, and I think all of those people, with the exception of Joy, I know, and I think they're going to be so exciting to listen to.
And we have some bloggers on some of the other panels, too. I know, trying to think of some of the others that will come to me. But, you know, it's a great event. And what's nice is that the cross-pollination we found sort of expanded into the people attending the event as well. Last year, we had this really great sense of community where designers came out on Friday, and we weren't sure whether they would come back on Saturday or not, because the Saturday agenda was geared a little bit more, it wasn't quite as serious as the Friday. The Friday was geared a little bit more serious talks and a little bit more educational than the Saturday agenda. And so, but on Saturday they did come out. And what was fun after them being there all day on Friday and sitting in some of these panels alongside fellow designers is that they develop friendships. And on Saturday, they were walking around together and they were sharing resources and they were, you know, talking, going to coffee and going to drinks with each other. And it's a really great sense of community. It's a really great event. It's Main Street USA all over, you know.
I'm so jealous I'm not out there.
Well, you should come out.
We don't have anything like this in Boston.
Well, you should
come
out.
You do in New York, though. Yeah, you should, both of you.
I know.
I'm dying over the website. I mean, you have some gorgeous stuff on, I mean, stuff.
Joni wants the price tags printed there.
Yeah, why don't you put your prices on? I'm wondering.
Well, my method? The reason primarily is because I guess I have found that a lot of the dealers, not just local dealers, but dealers throughout the country and even some of the places where I purchase them, once I put prices on, I find that people utilize that to, especially where some of the sources that I buy from, once they start to see prices, then they raise their prices to me, which in turn I have to raise my prices to my clients. So
okay.
I think it's, and I also have, you know, people going in and checking my pricing, and then they they adjust their prices either up or down to match my pricing. And so it just, you know, I think it allows people to, it forces people to call, and we get to talk about the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And although all our prices, I don't make up prices, you know, all the prices are established prices. You know, no matter, you know, it's, you know, if you came in one day and somebody else came in the next, they would be there. Everything has a price tag on it and everything is an established price. That isn't the reason why. A lot of people think that's why,
right.
But no, everything has an established price and it's the same price. It's just that we prefer to share that with people that are seriously interested in the piece.
How do people, when they're antiques, because this is the thing that confuses me the most, is the pricing. You can look at, you know, one dealer, reputable dealer, and you can look at roughly the same kind of thing, for instance, a sconce, or, you know, French 1940s sconce. And you can look at another place, and it's, you know, a tenth of the cost.
Right.
And, you know, and maybe sometimes you can, you know, you can tell the difference, but sometimes you're just like, well, where did, you know, how do you know, what's the best way of making sure you know you're paying the right price or close to the right price for a piece?
Well, I think mainly people have to consider how much they love the piece, because the more you love it, the more you're willing to pay for it.
True.
but I think, you know, you know, I price things based upon how I pay for them. So if I get a good buy on a piece, I sell them at a good buy. And so I like somebody to have the same experience that I have when I go shopping in Europe. There's a certain sense of satisfaction when I find something at a really great price. And so if I can pass that good price on to my clients, they can experience that same pleasure that I experience.
You know, that's interesting, because there's a dealer in Houston, Joyce Horn, who does that exact thing. She, every deal that she finds, she doesn't have automatic pricing. She has automatic percent pricing. So no matter what she pays for it, despite what it's worth on the market, she will, you know, it's only price percent wise, right? So you can find great deals there, you know, whereas other dealers in Houston are not like that. They put a value of what it's worth as opposed to what she bought it at. So that's interesting that you say that.
Yeah, I mean I just find that I want people to have that same joy that I have, that they got a good deal when they came in. It's like, wow, I only paid so much for this, and I just saw it down the street for double the price. And so, you know, I like that, to pass on that same sense of pleasure that I get in getting a good price on to my clients.
Well, you not buy for yourself the whole time. I'd be so on these trips. Is it hard not to take a little home for yourself as well?
I usually take one piece home from each trip initially. And then I I only allow myself to take one piece home initially. I buy one thing specifically for my private collection. And then I have this rule that everything has to go into the showroom. And if something is there for over a month, then I have the liberty to take it home if I want.
And do you personally collect? Is there something that you actually collect?
Yeah, I was wondering that.
Well, I have a home in Laguna Beach, and in that home it's much more traditional, and it's, 18th and 19th century antiques. And in that house, I have a nice mixture of Italian and English pieces. And then I have my guest quarters is all decorated in campaign furniture. And
love to see that.
I know.
It's fun because
has that been photographed?
No, I haven't had it photographed yet. It will be soon though. So, and then my home.
Okay, go on. I'm sorry.
And then my home in Los Angeles is in a high rise, and I decided to show people how you can utilize antiques in a contemporary environment, and so I have everything, it looks more gallery like, and so it has everything is very clean. It has bleached Belgian oak floors on the floor, and the walls are all white, and everything is very crisp, but it's all decorated in antiques. But they're all the antiques are very clean lined and very straight. And so it takes on a very contemporary look.
Lee, on your website, under design services, you have a room, the turret. Is that your house?
Yes, that's the turret my home in Laguna.
Oh, my God. That is gorgeous.
And that home was, when I designed that home, it was the reason I went with the style that it is. It's an English arts and crafts home, and the English arts and crafts period is a perfect period, especially the English arts and crafts as opposed to American arts and crafts, is great because they borrowed so many elements from other periods. And it's very forgiving to have an 18th century Italian console sitting right beside a 19th century English or French piece. And so it afforded me the opportunity to have an eclectic collection and still everything period pieces. And so
I'm assuming that this picture with the, where the, you have the, paneling.
Okay, Joni, where are you?
I'm on his website under design services.
You go to Lee Stanton Home, and then at the bottom there's a link for design services, Megan.
So that's your house too. I'm assuming where you have the.
I think I have two photographs from my house. Yeah. I didn't want to photograph the entire house because it is going to be published, and so I didn't want to overexpose it before it got published.
All right. Well, it looks stunning.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I enjoy it.
Do you have a favorite piece, or outside of just the collections, is there one piece that you absolutely love?
A lot of pieces that I love, but I would say, in my home in Laguna, probably the piece that I loved the most was, both of them were in my bedroom. One is my bed. And the interesting thing about the bed is that it is a true antique king-size bed. A lot of people don't realize that. An English, today we have king-size beds, and they're basically a contemporary thought. However, the concept basically came from royalty who had larger beds. And so that's how it got the term king-size bed, because it was the bed that was the same size that was fit for a king, literally. And so that's where the expression king-size bed came from. And so I have a bed that came from royalty that has on the headboard, it has the authentic, real candlesticks that people would read from on their bed. And so that is probably one of my favorite pieces. It was a unique find. And the other one is I have a large Italian piece cupboard that's in there that is a painted piece, and it has a garden scene on the piece. It's probably 9 feet wide by nine or 10 feet high, and it has a huge garden scene on it, and it's another favorite piece of mine.
Do you ever learn much about the history or the stories behind the pieces, or are you ever buying from family members who have things have been passed down and they're finally getting rid of pieces?
I love to buy things with, you know, heritage, the provenance. It's funny because I had a friend over for a dinner party, and he actually bought another friend with him that claimed that he was clairvoyant. And he came over once and was walking through my bedroom and saw the bed, and he sort of stopped in his tracks and he said, "Oh, this bed came from royalty." And he said the wife had spent many lonely nights in this bed. And while her husband was all overseas, you know, negotiating contracts and so on and so forth, and agreements with other countries. And she, he said, you know, the wife spent many lonely nights in this bed.
It's been cursed.
I noticed your collection of things that you sell is very current. I mean, it's very, I mean, I'm not going to say trendy, but you definitely are up on what people are buying, I'll say. You know, like a lot of clock faces, a lot of garden accessories, and which is nice, because sometimes you go in, some dealers just don't, you know, they get stuck on a look from 20 years ago and they don't move on to what people are buying, you know.
I think, you know, one of the things that has, you know, well, for one thing, it's an interest of mine to do so, but I think what keeps me really in tune to what people are buying is being right in Los Angeles, where we have, you know, it's such a creative city with, you know, even, you know, whether you have clients from the entertainment industry or whatever industry they're from, for the most part, everyone has some connection with some creative field in Los Angeles. And I think that is keeps me on the ball. You know, I have to keep my eye right on the ball on that and make sure that, you know, I'm staying with the current demands. Like I said,
yeah,
I'm surrounded.
But a lot of dealers don't.
Well, I think a lot of that I attribute, number one, to people that are in the antique business that don't have a true love for antiques. And then two, people that are just lazy. You know, you have a lot of people in the business that have, you know, been in the business for 40 years and they still do business the same way and they still mm-hmm. like the same pieces. And you know, it's good to go to that person if you're looking for that particular period of piece or that particular look that for something to complete a room. But if you, you know, they just have a tendency to get stuck in their own world. And I love to expand, you know, that's the thing about the antique business that just fascinates me. I come home from every buying trip with something that I have never had in my showroom before and something that encourages me to learn more.
There's a designer in Houston, you know, famous one that's gotten a lot of press, Young. And he was telling me that he has been buying a lot of Scottish and Irish antiques and,
really?
And warehousing it because, well, he's getting ready to redo his whole house. He bought a new house, but he's been, you know, hoarding Irish antiques, and that he says there's going to, I mean, do you understand that?
Oh, yes. Countries like Scotland and Ireland, they have, a lot of their things have been lost over the decades for economic reasons, and they've just been consumed by England, you know, for the most part. And so those Scottish and Irish antiques are just getting more and more rare. It's like a, It's like American Antiques, you know, a piece from Boston, and, you know, being in Boston, you can, you know, there are people that are very particular about those pieces, but they're very rare.
They're very rare, yeah. There just wasn't that much. Well, there weren't that many people here to be building those pieces.
Right. You know, it's funny. I have a funny story about Boston. When I first started in the antique business, I happened to go in Boston for a completely separate reason, but I decided to, as I always do, to do some antique shopping while I was in Boston. And I walked into an antique shop, and I immediately over in the corner spotted a pair of beautiful English Windsor chairs. And I went up to him, and as I'm going up to him, the dealer said to me, in a very condescending way, it's like, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And I said, "What?" She said, I'm thinking she's saying, going to say they were sold or they were reproductions or something. And as I got closer to him, she said, "I'm so sorry, those are English." And here in California, we can sell, I mean, English would sell over an American piece anytime.
Yeah.
But in Boston, you know, that was, it was just this very condescending approach towards an English piece as opposed to an American Windsor chair.
Yeah.
And she was apologizing for the fact that it was an English Windsor as opposed to an American Windsor. And which I think, you know, this kind of goes... something that I didn't mention before about when you were mentioning pricing. I think one thing that people have to keep in mind is that, you know, antiques really are only worth what somebody's willing to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And depending on the geographical market, things are different. For instance, an American piece in Boston or New York or in the New England states, they are going to, fetch a really great price, where an American piece here in Los Angeles will not fetch as high of a price. And the same goes for, you know, English pieces there. So in all fairness, you can sometimes find pieces in geographical areas just that, you know, the people in that market don't appreciate that particular era or the country that piece is from, or the look, you know, just the overall look of the piece, because things do change from market to market. And so when you are tuned into the Antiques Roadshow, you know, sometimes those prices are, you know, I warn people that, you know, tune into the Antiques Roadshow, that those prices are based upon prices that, you know, may not be appropriate in your geographical market.
Which I think is why I know in Antiques Roadshow they try, because I used to work in a related business to Antique Roadshow, and I know they try to get local appraisers for the areas where they're filming in for that reason, but I'm sure it doesn't always jibe, which makes, you know, total sense, you know, when they,
right.
I'm sure they bring in some from other areas who, because they don't ever say, in this area, you know, in New York you could get this much. They just think, well, the most you could get would be.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes when I'm watching the show, I look at something and I say, oh, I could never get that price for that piece. And then there are certain times that I feel like picking up the phone and asking the person if I can buy the piece. It's so underpriced.
Did you buy those English Windsor chairs in Boston?
Actually, they were very reasonably priced, but I was, like I said, I was new in the business, and so I still didn't quite have all the resources for, okay, how am I going to get these two, you know, just two English chairs to California? And like I said, I was there for another reason. I know I ended up not buying them, but they were very reasonably priced, and to this day, I'm sorry I didn't purchase them and worry about how I was going to get them to California later, because today, you know, I have resources to get things anywhere across the country or across the world.
Right,
you know.
Right. I have to admit, I just don't like Windsor chairs. I'm probably the only person from New England who doesn't, but I think it's just there's so many cheap reproductions that you can't look at a real estate listing without seeing it's sort of like New England home, Windsor chair.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
I mean, to a certain extent, that's happening with so many antiques. I think that is the largest challenge that antique dealers and people that are decorating are finding today. You know, to go out, they can go, I don't know, like, for instance, confit pots. You know, we used to sell confit pots like crazy, and they were, you know, they were this incredible color with incredible patina and just so beautiful. And, you know, then all of a sudden, you know, they're reproduced and they're sold at the Crate and Barrels or the Williams-Sonoma, and they're brand new, but, you know, they have a fairly good look. And if they're sitting up on a bookshelf, you know,
it's harder to tell.
It's hard to tell, but for the exact reason that you mentioned, you don't like in Windsor's, you know, it's the same, you know, I have to be careful that every day, you know, if I buy things, it's like, what, somebody called me the other day and they said, you know, have you gotten the Restoration Hardware catalog the other day? Because you can pick that up and, you know, they're making, you know, fairly decent copies of them. You know, they're the real purists can tell the difference, but if you're just going for a look and don't really want, you know, people aren't going to go up and really inspect the piece, you know, they can give you the look at a less expensive right. cost, you know, but in many cases they're actually more expensive.
It's not cheap at Restoration Hardware, but it is a gorgeous catalog for the masses. There's no doubt about it. But Linda,
yes.
The thing is, you take those Windsor chairs out of Boston and out of a home that's filled with Americana and put them in a contemporary setting, and they shine.
There's no question. When you see one in person that's a real, you know, whether it's a Thomas Mosier, you know, that's newly made but incredibly craftsman-oriented, or a traditional, you know, 17th century one, if you stand and look at it, there's no question, it's incredible. Windsor chair. It's just that they become so ubiquitous.
I know what you're talking about. It's
boring in a house full.
It becomes almost theme-like when you see them in New England when you're out searching for a house to buy. You're exactly right, Linda. I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's just sort of that, you know, the realtor, well, put in a Windsor chair because it'll say this house is antique. It's like, you know, the house itself says it's antique if it's really antique.
I think that's that is the importance of an antique is patina. And I think if you look at a really good old English or American Windsor, for that matter, that has the worn arms from somebody using it, you know, I just love thinking, you know, somebody really enjoyed this chair for this arm to be sort of worn down and have a great patina on it, or the seat to have just this shine just based upon use. It's something that is really great. And you put that piece, like you mentioned, beside a metal, an old industrial cabinet from the 30s, and you put that English Windsor in front of it, and man, that is going to make a statement.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. You know, that warmth and that patina on that chair beside an industrial metal cabinet or an industrial clock, for instance, is just going to, you know, be smash.
You just can't fake that patina. I mean, you can't fake antique patina, I don't think, good, you know. No. I just don't think you can.
This kind of comes back to your question on, you know, having the knowledge to make sure you don't buy fakes. You know, I sort of feel like a piece speaks to me, and that patina really speaks to me, and I can tell when a piece doesn't have the worn spots in the right places. I mean, you know, if somebody bothers to try and look, make a piece look worn, and it's on the side of a piece that never really normally gets worn as opposed to the drawers, you'd be rest assured that that piece is probably a fake.
Mm-hmm. But you know what, like on a painted piece, let's say a painted piece, and they try to make, you know, put those worn spots. A true painted piece that's worn is usually, it's dirty. You know, it's like dirty from fingerprints over and over and over. You can't replicate that.
I mean, the oils from people's skin over time, it becomes the finish on pieces. And so that just adds the patina. That's like I said, the arm on a Windsor chair, you know. When you rest your hands on an old, any type of wooden chair, and you know, you feel that where your hands go, you can just sort of sense, you know, the hands that have touched that piece over the years, and really appreciate the integrity of the piece and the love that other generations have had on for that piece. And you know, it's nice to feel that love is being passed on, you know, to your own joy.
Yeah.
Well, one problem though is people are so much bigger today. That's you know, especially in dining room chairs. You know, they just don't. The men don't fit the chairs anymore.
And that's the problem that I have to learn when I buy. Is that, you know, like I said, I sit in some of these chairs after long days, and anything would be comfortable, and I bring it back, and then, you know, this, you know, 6'2" man goes to sit in a dining room chair, that an antique dining room chair, and he goes, this is uncomfortable.
I think those are probably hard to sell as sets of antique dining room chairs because of the scale is so off, you know, for us today.
Well, we like to be a lot more comfortable when we're eating than the, you know, in the days back, you know, in formal England or France, you know, people had to sit up very straight when they were eating. It was just, you know, it was proper to do so. And today we have a much more casual way of dining than what we used to.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that combined with, you know, how large we are today compared to those days. Yeah.
What did you study at USC?
I studied international relations and economics.
I can definitely see how that would play in well to me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a lot of times buying, in order to find the really good pieces, it takes a lot of perseverance, but a lot of negotiating, because you have to convince people when you're going into a home to sell something that, you know, that they were going to save for something else, or that, you know, they were trying to hold off for a higher price on, or just, you know, for instance, in Italy, I have a translator that goes around and buys with me, and, you know, she sort of does the Italian conversation with them, and gets them loving her, and she does everything down to, you know, blinking her eyes at people in order to, you know, kind of flirt with them.
I was going to ask you that. I wondered how many languages you spoke and if you were the one having to do the negotiating, but no.
Yeah, I speak a little bit of Italian. I know my woods in Italian. I know my periods in Italian. It's not conversational, and the same goes for France. But particularly in Italy, mainly because I have to buy so fast. I go to the fairs because everything's most antique shops are so spread out there that you have to go to fairs in Italy, and so you have to, when you have a fair where there are dealers there from all over the world, people are buying very quickly, and so you don't have the luxury of time of a you know that not being able to converse properly and fast. And so to go around with an interpreter that can immediately establish a rapport with the seller and help negotiate, and like I said, use, you know, all kinds of charm and so on and so forth, that quite frankly, you know, it's difficult for me to do because I'm running around trying to buy things as quickly as possible.
And it's a madhouse, isn't it? I've seen this where people, Man Shops Globe. Have you ever seen that show that's on Sundance? It's a guy who's a buyer for Anthropology, the chain. But they show him at this, for somebody who's never been to one of these European antique shows or fairs, it's really fascinating. I mean, people there really early, and they are, it's like the running of the bulls practically. I mean, they're like running through there.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
In France, they, to a certain extent, it's still true. When you go to these fairs, there's a sort of a unwritten rule that if you're looking at a piece, you have to keep your hand on it if you're still considering it. The minute you take your hand off the piece, somebody else can buy it from behind you. And so, you know, you know, you go up to a piece and you're considering it, and then you step back to look at it overall, somebody can actually buy it. But if you have your hand on the piece, it's yours until you actually make the purchase.
And if you didn't know that, boy, you'd be in trouble.
Yeah. And it's hard when you, you know, I always get close to a piece to look underneath and look all around it and determine the, you know, the integrity of the piece. But a lot of times you have to stand back to get a perspective of it and from a design point of view. And to do that, you have to have very long arms.
Or bring an assistant.
Yeah.
Or put your toe on
your
it.
Your holder.
And I hope you do come out to Legends of La Cienega.
I hope they do, too. I'm going to be there.
Well, stop
it. Have you ever met him?
I've never met him in person. I've heard about him for years, and I've never met Lee in person, but I will. I'm going to definitely.
Well, stop in, and I have two lectures going on in my place. One is called Mantique, which is about, you know, masculine design and the use of antiques and fighting the notion that, you know, antiques are all feminine and sort of fussy. And so one is on that. We have the lead designer from Jaguar that's going to be here for it on that panel. Waldo Fernandez will be on that panel. And so it will be a great panel. And then Vintage Lineage, Margaret Russell will be on that panel from El Decor. She's moderating that panel. And we have Matt Catherine Malandrino on that panel along with Chris Barrett and Cameron Silver. And I don't know if you're all familiar with Cameron Silver, but he sells vintage clothing. And so it will be it's a nice topic on how you take something classic and make it modern. So those are good, you know, two great panels. So I hope you attend
those. They do sound
great.
I like that.
And there's 14 other, you know, there's 12 other panels that are just absolutely incredible.
I just did a post today on Virgil McDowell. Does he buy from you ever? I don't think he would.
Yeah, Virgil buys for me, and he's very talented. I respect Virgil to a great extent, and he's going to be on one of the panels.
Yeah,
he'll be on East Meets West, which is at Rose.
Yeah, he had told me about that. I'm excited.
Yeah,
I feel so fortunate that we have this sort of thing. I'm so excited that you and everyone else who's been part of this has put this together, because it just means one more. You know, like you said, like Main Street USA for the designers and the design, and to the public, for people who aren't necessarily in the trade, but who want to be around it, want to be exposed to it, and hear all these people speak.
And it's really a great opportunity for the public, if they are considering a designer, to really rub elbows with the designers and get a sense of, you know, their personality, the way they, you know, the way they buy and the way they sell and so on and so forth. And so it's a great way, if you are considering a designer, to, like I said, rub elbows with them and really get to know them. Because, you know, when you hire a designer, it's a relationship. And to be able to sit at a lecture and or a panel and talk to them and see their thought patterns, and you can really imagine whether, you know, you can develop a relationship. And this is, you know, your home is a very personal place, and so to build a relationship with somebody that you really, you know, like and trust with your home is really important.
Well, Lee, this has been very interesting. We're coming up just about an hour, so that went very quick.
I've really enjoyed this. This has been great. You've made me think about things that I haven't thought about in a long time.
This has been the Skirted Roundtable with Megan Arquette from Beach Bungalow 8, Joni Webb from Cota, Texas, and I'm Linda Merrill from Surroundings. And this week we welcomed noted antiquarian Lee Stanton to the table. Thank you so much for joining us. You can visit us online at www.skirtedroundtable.blogspot.com or download our podcast from iTunes. Search for the Skirted Roundtable. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back soon.